Welcome to Ask a Leader. I am your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the December 9, 2014 edition. Dr. Laura Mosqueda, renowned geriatrician, previously at UCI and now at USC, will talk about Dr. Atul Gawande's recently published book, Being Mortal, a most thoughtful treatment of the aging process and why we better start a relationship with a qualified geriatrician yesterday. Sally Geisler, PhD candidate in urban planning and director of the Food Works Lab, will update local chefs and shoppers on the relocation of the ever-successful Irvine Saturday Farmers Market. And there's a forum leading up to that and the commemoration, the 20 years here. With the time remaining, and we're going to get it all in today, everybody, we'll give Ada Lovelace and other early computing science women as their due. So, folks, we've got a veritable cornucopia on. We'll be right back in just seconds. Welcome with my first guest, Dr. Laura Mosqueda. Dr. Mosqueda is a professor of family medicine and geriatrics at the Keck School of Medicine of USC, where she is also the associate dean of primary care and the chair of the Department of Family Medicine. She is the director of the National Center on Elder Abuse, which is housed at the University of Southern California, also known as USC. Dr. Mosqueda founded the first Elder Abuse Forensic Center in the United States and continues to see victims of abuse and neglect in the field. She has taught professionals in many fields, including medicine, criminal justice, and social services. Dr. Mosqueda has published extensively in scientific journals and textbooks and has been recognized nationally for her breakthrough work and service in geriatrics. She earned her BA at Occidental College, her MD at UCLA, and her residency at USC's Glendale Adventist Medical Center. We are fortunate today to have her with us to talk about a very special, and I would argue, an essential look at geriatrics in America, the book Being Mortal by physician Atul Gawande. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Dr. Mosqueda.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Claudia.
Well, I'm glad that you signed on. Once I had been reading and hearing about Dr. Gawande's book, I thought, you are the one, and now I've finished reading the book. Did you get a chance to look a little bit inside?
I sure did.
Okay. Well, and on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is this for listeners to read?
Oh, probably an 11.
11. I much agreed. Well, I've mentioned in your bio about the elder abuse being a central part of your training and administration. I guess it's not considered elder abuse, but there's a fine line between what kinds of choices elders face when they are approaching what is a terminal condition and all that. Dr. Gawande is trying to bring in the idea of it's our death is like our story. We would rather be able to be authors of our own death. I guess carrying out a good death or the opportunity to close our individual stories, it's stacked up against us in America. So I want for you to talk to us today, Dr. Mosqueda, about what are you doing in your capacity with training physicians. Are you training geriatricians along the way with the family medicine area?
Yes, and I think this is being done also in an outstanding way at UCI. We really need to focus more training on the care of older adults when people are in medical school, because most physicians, with the exception of neonatologists and pediatricians, will be working quite extensively with older adults, and there's precious little required training in the field of geriatrics in medical education. So we're working hard at improving and increasing that.
Dr. Gawande says that he talks about there is currently there is a considerable shortage, and that's one of the serious takeaways from this book. So, and he's saying a shortage of geriatricians, and we're not even talking about qualified geriatricians. But how are you recruiting? How are you reaching out to find that medical trainee who is suited for this kind of a thing? Or are they? Is it a transformative kind of training where they actually, amidst doing their residencies and all that, they have a budding ability, an aptitude for working with elder and terminal patients?
Well, you're just bringing up such a great point right now, Claudia, in that many students, whether you're looking at medical students, social work students, nursing students, may not feel a real affinity for older adults. And in fact, you know, most of the students going into these various healthcare professions are young folks. They're in their early 20s. They may or may not have had much exposure to older adults. They may have a lot of negative views about aging. They might be fearful of older adults, not know how to communicate with somebody who has Alzheimer's disease, et cetera. And it's not too surprising that there's a real attraction to working with younger people. Wanting to work with kids and young adults and where there is a sense of, well, there's hope and there's so much more that we can do. I hear this very often from students in a variety of healthcare professions. Geriatrics is not a particularly sexy field to go into. We try to prevent falls. We talk to people about end-of-life decisions. We talk about their daily function. We're not going in and curing cancer. We're really about helping people live the best lives they can. And I think that's a point that Dr. Gawande also makes in his book about the field of geriatrics.
I know, as you say, it's not sexy, but I guess I'm thinking once someone has a personalized encounter, whether it's a loved one, I don't mean just a relative, but maybe a neighbor that they know well. I think, isn't that one kind of sort of introduction, an entree of sort of what special zone that is, that geriatric zone that can actually open up what is so appealing for those practitioners in that field?
Yeah, I think that those sorts of connections are very important. You know, one thing that we're working on in quite a few schools across the country is helping medical students link to older adults during their first couple of years of medical school so that they maybe develop a bit more of a relationship as they may not have when they were growing up. I'm always happy in my clinical practice when one of my older adult patients might be accompanied by a younger grandchild. And that you get a sense that the grandchildren are perhaps involved in the lives of the older adult. Or if I go on a house call to see that there are grandchildren around who are seeing what it's like to help take care of grandma or grandpa, and that this is not so much an obligation but an honor to be doing on the part of the family. Of course, this can cross over into dark sides too, which we might get to in a moment.
Yes,
but for the most part, this can be a tremendously valuable, meaningful, loving experience that helps shape not only individual people but really indeed the world.
Well, I guess that part of that, the dark side you're talking about there, there is a mixed message that Dr. Gawande talks about. It's, well, I guess the first takeaway is there's a reassurance and a troubling thing about what he calls the zen of questions, conversations to have with that patient. So it's a matter of how you can get into what it is that their wishes are, and then the dark side is that maybe one of the dark sides you're referring to is approaching the question of the dying process, how to transition from caring for the patient to conversing about, folks, this is, we are talking about dying now. We're not talking about recovery.
Right. And, you know, physicians and other healthcare providers need to confront our own expectations, fears, attitudes about the aging and the dying process within ourselves so that we are comfortable having these conversations with our patients. And that is something that takes work. And then also takes practice in having these conversations. I think it takes role models so that students, residents, fellows, colleagues can see how other people do it well.
Yes.
And then we begin to shape our own method for having these conversations with our patients and their families.
And conversations means listening and telling. And Dr. Gawande has that kind of he talks about later about that kind of formula. And the listening, I think physicians have a default that's about telling, and so the listening is what you're having a delicate teaching conundrum about, correct?
That's correct. One thing we try to stress, or not try to, we do stress, is
right.
that listening is the most important skill for a physician to learn when communicating with a patient. And it's a very much of an active listening process.
And it's not about so that somebody can complete an evaluation form and say they're listening. The listening is offers huge yields with what the patient is really desiring when there's so many particular options to pursue.
Yes, it's an opportunity for us to understand somebody's values and goals and motivations. It's an opportunity to build a trusting relationship so that people feel not only listened but cared for and cared about. And it's that kind of relationship that then allows us sometimes to push into areas that perhaps our patients and families don't really want to discuss, yet we know can become very, very important very, very soon.
And the reassuring part of that is that breakthrough with listening, discerning what the wishes are, and an astute medical background would then yield an opportunity to offer relief in pain, offer relief in sort of the uncertainty, and a relief to sort of disconnect the patient from the medicalizing of their situation and giving them, he gives so many examples of how their treatments interfere with getting the actual relief, interfere with them being more mobile, all those things. I'm over the map here. It is reassuring that addressing these questions, listening carefully, that you are able to really make for a joyful and a cleaner, approachable kind of process.
That's right. And I feel that my role and responsibility is to help my patients be their best. And it's their definition of what their best might be. And that means also when we start entering into final phases of life, we might be entering into a dying process, to participate with them in that process, in that conversation. I might take the lead, they might take the lead, it might change. You know, it's a bit of a dance that goes on during these final phases. We have to understand what their loved ones are thinking and what some of the relationships are like there as well. Because one of the goals I have when one of my patients is entering into a dying phase is not only to make that process as comfortable and dignified for them as possible,
right.
But I also want to help assure that this family is going to be left intact in the years to come so that they don't end up arguing over what happened over mom in her final phases and you end up then with siblings who are mad at each other. That really part of my job is to look at the whole family and to help them all with this process.
Which is so fraught. For those of you who've just joined us, my guest on Ask Leader is Dr. Laura Mosqueda, Associate Dean of Primary Care, professor and chair of family medicine at geriatrics at USC, on Ask a Leader on KUCI 80.9 FM in Irvine, streaming in waiting rooms in home hospice care settings around the world on KUCI.org. Well, speaking of hospice, as I skip through all these things, we can go back and open up a few things in more detail, but I want for people to, we put hospice here in the center. Patients are mixed about what they think when the H word is introduced. You've got that layer, and let's talk about the other layer, Dr. Mosqueda, of physicians. It may not even occur to them to bring up hospice. How do you, let's talk with the physicians part in this dance. How are physicians in their early medical training or in, let's say, continuing medical education units, how are they trained to bring a hospice process to a terminally ill patient?
Well, I can tell you what I do and what I try to model for students, residents, fellows. I think that people in training need to see what more experienced physicians are doing, and that even as a more experienced physician, I really like to observe my colleagues and have them observe me to give me feedback on these sorts of sometimes difficult conversations. The more knowledgeable and comfortable we are as clinicians, the more knowledgeable and comfortable we can help our patients and families become. So I think that's really part of the key, that when we enter into that conversation, one of the things you don't want to do is say, well, there's nothing more we can do, so we're looking at hospice. For me, it's more of a conversation along the lines of, we're entering into a new phase, our goals have changed, what we hope for changes, now it's time for us to talk about hospice. And then the next thing I want to do is see what my patient or family knows about hospice.
Right.
It's so common this is now what you just talked about before, the act of listening comes in. What do you understand about hospice? And then I have to sit back and hear what their perceptions are. Some people are very very astute and have seen very good experiences with hospice and have very positive attitudes and understand that this is the right stage that we're in now. Others find it very frightening. Others have a lot of myths. So that's my opportunity to hear their understanding and then work with them to maybe clarify, answer questions, and if I can't answer them, get people who are more knowledgeable than me involved.
When do training medical professionals, where is that introduced? What kind of program? Is it medical school? Is it their residencies? Or where is it getting started?
Well, you begin to you have to remember now, medical education is a process too, because
right,
as people are going through this, it's not only, I always tell my teammates, it's professional growth cannot be separated from personal growth.
Exactly.
And particularly when you have people who are in their 20s, there's still a lot of personal growth going on along with the professional growth. So we start to educate students and teach them about what hospice is, what it's designed for. And even at USC, we have a wonderful course called Introduction to Clinical Medicine, where from the very first week of medical school, our students are interacting with patients. And as they begin to get more comfortable in these conversations, during this course, over the first 2 years, they'll end up seeing patients in hospice, witnessing some of these conversations, talking to people, and beginning to learn how you have these conversations when it's appropriate to do so. And then, of course, beyond medical school, during our residencies in family medicine, internal medicine, really in all residencies, pediatrics, et cetera, people have more opportunity for personal and professional growth and conversations about what some people would consider difficult topics, such as end of life and hospice.
Dr. Mosqueda, there was one really mind-blowing, among other mind-blowing aspects to Dr. Atul Gawande's being mortal, and that was the timing. The timing that is in the patient's head of their terminal processing of their disease, the timing in their family members' heads, and the timing in the physician's heads. And so He talks about the percentage of physicians in on average, how far off they are in imagining the length of that person's remaining life. And Dr. Gawande also plots the sort of, I don't know if I can do this visually on, but you know what I'm talking about, Dr. Mosqueda, that most patients are thinking they are at the long end of that recovery duration, and that is where maybe there are the probabilities are extremely low that they get to that length of survival, but most patients are clustered around the shorter duration of processing that disease toward their actual dying. And Dr. Gawande lays that out really well, but I'm just trying to figure out from my note here what he says about the percentage of the physicians. They're like the average. They're about, he says, 520% off of their estimate of how long that person has to live. And we're not getting to quality. We're just getting at their longevity. Did you want to react to what Dr. Gawande has, what he's learned and researched, and your own practice?
Yeah, I don't even try to guesstimate how long somebody has to live anymore. I've learned that I'm no good at it. And really, that's generally not the most important question. Or if that's the question that's being asked, which is a very common question I get, more from families than from my patients, you want to dig a little bit deeper and understand why they're asking that and what it is they really want to know.
Yes.
And then what I will typically do is try and help guide us toward the values or the philosophy behind that question rather than coming up with a number. And I'm very frank with my patients, which is, I don't know. I'm lousy at guessing. I used to try to guess, and I don't even do it anymore because I don't know.
How do they react to that uncertain reply? Is that reassuring to them, or do they think, okay, this person is into the listener or something? What's their reaction?
I think they feel listened to. Some probably are disappointed. I think many appreciate my honesty, and I don't just leave it at that.
No.
You know, I think it then enables us to have a bigger conversation about, well, what is it we can do today, and what is it that you want to look forward to during this process, and whether it's short or long, what are those things that are most meaningful to you that we would like to help ensure, and that usually ends up becoming a more important conversation than, do you think it's going to be 2 weeks or 4 weeks kind of a conversation.
And when we're talking about longevity, we have to really make the centerpiece of the closing of this discussion here is that there's an irony, I think, for mainstream consumers of medicine to consider that without life, what's called life prolongment, like chemo and radiation, with the discontinuing of those sorts of treatments and going into hospice other sort of more basic sort of medical attention, that not only does the quality improve, but the irony is their life lengthens. Can you talk to our listeners about your experience with that?
Well, that's been well proven now, that people who stop getting some of this aggressive treatment and go on what sometimes is called palliative care, but really where the focus becomes on quality of life, it's not on cure, it's on care, have a better quality of life and actually end up outliving some of their counterparts who still continue to go after this very aggressive treatment. And it's one thing to say that there are studies that show this, which are absolutely true. It really, in the trenches, it becomes a very individual decision. And one of the challenges, whether you're talking about this or almost any medical treatment, one of the challenges is taking a big study and applying it to this person at this time in their lives and seeing how, you know, big numbers apply to an individual. So we always do that with caution. I think one of the things that actually worried me about Dr. Gawande's attitude was I thought he actually had a fairly negative attitude about aging, which was a little concerning to me.
Yes.
In a book that I think is really wonderful. I think it's a great book for book clubs, and it can really stimulate discussion. And if people who are listening are considering using it for that purpose, I think it would be interesting for people to dig in a little about his, what I perceived as some negative stereotypes and attitudes.
Please
about
do.
The aging process.
Please go ahead and package that with the time remaining.
Well, I think that he views it in a negative and a sad way. He even used terms like the tragedy of aging. And I would say, as a geriatrician, I don't view aging as a tragedy. Many people have fulfilling, meaningful lives as we get older. In fact, most people do. I think the tragedy is that we've over-medicalized the aging process, and we certainly have over-medicalized the dying process. And we're at an opportunity now in this country to take it back from the medical community and have physicians such as myself participate, but in a way that's really guided by our patients and their families.
Well, I think that points to this, what you were talking earlier about the personal and professional education. Dr. Gawande, I would put him at about his early 40s. And so I don't think he even with his experience, can see he's looking at parts that are not working the same way, that are getting lost and all that, but that the aging keeps bringing on sort of enrichment in one's life that you don't know until you're there.
True. And some people really find that when they're in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, that it's one of the most creative and interesting and introspective times of life that brings a lot of fulfillment and enjoyment. It's different for different people. I hate to think of aging as a tragedy.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad that we had this chance to consider this book, which I don't think necessarily just for the book clubs. Book clubs will have there'll be an immediately interactive discussion about these topics. But I'm thinking, when I'm recommending it now, I've got two people lined up to take my copy over after this interview. But I'm thinking of it for us to prepare ourselves for how we are consumers of our elder loved ones' medical care, and for us to consider. And I closed up this book and I finished reading. I turned to my daughter and I said, "We're going to have a conversation."
That's wonderful. I think that's if the book does nothing else but start a lot of conversations between parents and children, that would be a wonderful thing to happen.
And a way to sort of help us know how to get the physician to listen, as we talked about that dichotomy of the telling and the listening, and how to be better consumers. But I am concerned, as we wrap this, what are we going to do until we've got an adequate supply of geriatricians? We're at the mercy of primary care physicians that are, as you said, they're focused on the sexier part of medicine. But how are we going to deal with that shortfall?
We're never going to have enough geriatricians. And the good part is that many, many primary care physicians, I would say the vast majority, do an excellent job of caring for older adults.
Yes.
I think geriatricians' role will evolve to become both consultants and primary care docs for perhaps more of the really frail older adults. But many family physicians, general internists, pediatricians, gynecologists do a very good job, and I think are doing a better and better job at having these sorts of conversations with our patients.
And maybe for some solace, do you see, Dr. Mosqueda, you're being very generous with your time, and I thank you for that, do you see that some of the primary care physicians, as their own patient base ages, they're getting that geriatric piece, and they are assuming a more effective role in that dialogue?
Yes, I do think that there's the evolution of a physician, and that occurs as well, what you just mentioned. And I think we're doing a better job at teaching this in medical schools, like our Introduction to Clinical Medicine program, which starts with students their very first, very early in their first year, their first week of medical school, that we're teaching people how to become better listeners, how to open up these sorts of dialogues in a way that's both empathetic and compassionate. And those things are very, very important to do.
And yes, And I'm so glad that that we're having this opportunity. As Dr. Gawande says, writes, I think, right in, maybe in the very middle of the book is, it's in his epilogue, we have one death, all of us. We don't get to do it over. We have this one shot, and so it's so important that it is a considered rite of passage. It's a rite of passage. It's the last one we have, and that we can take it over and make the most of that one time we have, that our actual death.
Exactly right. It's not something you get to practice.
You don't get to practice. You learn about it through. I think it behooves us to attend to our elder loved ones. It gives us a chance to sort of observe, not and sort of practice in a peripheral way, but it does give us a chance. And I guess that was one of the takeaways I want to offer is involvement with our elders. It's not just helping them, it's giving us a huge yield in participating along with advocating and interacting with them. So Dr. Mosqueda, thank you so much for being back on Ask a Leader today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed our conversation, Claudia.
Thank you so much. We are going to be back after a brief break when we'll bring on Sally Geiser. That was Dr. Laura Mosqueda, Associate Dean of Primary Care Professor and Chair of Family Medicine Geriatrics at USC, about Dr. Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, just published this last fall by Metropolitan Books. We'll be back with Sally Geiser, as I say, just in a moment. She'll call us in from D.C. Thanks for listening. Well, as live radio has it, we have a little bit of a change. What I'll do for this moment, because I haven't gotten a call back in from Sally Geisler, social ecology PhD candidate, but what I'll do is introduce her, and I will mention what we would be covering, but without the depth and detail that she would offer in her PhD work. What we would be otherwise talking about is Sally Geisler of UCI's Planning, Policy, and Design at Social Ecology, who is, a PhD candidate, and she's currently heading up the FoodWorks Lab Welcome. I would welcome her here, but her research project is entitled Local Food Access and Advocacy, Cultivating Town and Gown Synergies. Her work is funded by the UC Global Food Initiative Fellowship of this academic year. She would be here to talk about this week's forum on the Farmers Market at Crystal Cove. It's on Thursday, folks, at 7 p.m. Check in on the podcast summary later after today when I'll be able to post it both on KUCI.org and askaleader.com. And you'll know where to RSVP, but it is Crystal Cove this Thursday. That's the 11th of December, 7 p.m. I know for some of you students, that would be a nice break from the utter excruciating strain of finals week. And you can, and I know that kind of a mind break. I just learned about this at a college tour I took with my daughter yesterday, at an unknown location, that little mind break at the Farmers Market Forum would be a wonderful place to turn out, and especially if you who've ever bonded with the local vendors that have congregated for the last 20 years at the Irvine, at the University Center. Part of the talk on Thursday will be to commemorate the 20th anniversary of what is the best of the farmers markets in Orange County. And this is also going to cover her survey that she was doing. And some of you may have been able to, you were interviewed and doing the survey with her, where she was determining all kinds of logistical and vending questions at the farmers market. And she would talk about that discovery, but we'll have to save that for when she presides at Thursday's forum at 7 o'clock. So we would be glad to have her on, but she may be, as she is in D.C. right now before returning to put the rest of the form together, was unable to get back to us. And so that is what is the lovely aspect of live and community radio. Not only is it the community, but we have changeable, exciting things. So what we're going to do instead is bring on our third guest for this show. And if Sally Geisler just checks in, we'll figure out how to relay the traffic. We've done traffic relays here before. So I'm going to welcome now Stephanie Ang, one of the leaders of the Women in Information Computer Sciences Club on campus. Stephanie was raised in Torrance, California, and she's a third-year student at, as I said, referring to, in a way, UCI's Information and Computer Sciences School. Stephanie gives us an excellent opportunity to take stock of Ada Lovelace and Grace Hopper in laying out for us a huge role that women have had in the discipline of computing. And we'll wrap up with a special workshop for girls in coding this Saturday. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Stephanie Ang.
Hi.
So, I mean, all eyes have been on Mr. Turing's absolutely ground-changing, World War diverting outcome of his own computer engineering feats to unravel the code in World War II, and I guess he started in 1938, was recruited, and was able to make amazing, definitive contributions in ending World War II. But I would like for us, with Stephanie Ang's help, to direct our attention where Ada Lovelace appears. She lived from 1815 to 1852. She was arguably the world's first computer program. Tell us what we need to know about Ada Lovelace, Stephanie.
Well, Ada Lovelace was a pretty interesting lady. Like you said, she was born December 10th, 1815, and she was actually the Countess of Lovelace. Let's see, she was an English mathematician, and she was a writer, primarily known for her work on Charles Babbage's early mechanical general-purpose computer. It was called the analytical engine.
I mean, that's what they called it in their time.
Right.
That was a contemporary term. Okay.
So the analytical engine is actually considered one of the first actual computers in the way that it created mathematical calculations, and it actually was able to solve them. So a little bit more about Ada Lovelace. She was, as a young adult, she was gifted with mathematical talents, and then she wound up working her way into a friendship with Charles Babbage. And by meeting him, she was able to work on some of his machines and some of his engines. And she also wrote a lot about the technical aspects of it, so how you would use it. And one of the most important things she did was writing about it. So one of the problems that early mathematicians had was they thought of all of their machines mathematically. So they thought only about how to solve mathematical problems using machines. But what Ada Lovelace did is she thought about those machines, and she thought about how she could use them for other things. For example, not just straight, pure mathematics, but creating a program to solve some problem in the world.
And you know much more about her than she, but I think it's really interesting if we consider a background of hers, that she had herself created poetry. So she had that kind of visual literary bundle of talents. And so that's where she had a sort of a broader approach to what was the computing sort of an engineering pioneer work. So I'm just for people to sort of imagine that. And I guess part of she was first involved in poetry, and that I guess her father was trying to sort of train her on something he thought was perhaps had more practical value, but she always had that poetic sort of sensibility in how she approached solving those problems.
Right. Actually, I think it's a little bit of the opposite.
Is it? Okay.
Her father was Lord Byron, the poet.
Right. That's right.
Right. So her father is the one who brought in the literary poetry, I suppose. And then her mother is the one who sort of steered her more towards math and engineering. The story goes that her mother actually had a little bit of a falling out with her father.
Yes.
And so she actually...
A big one.
Just a little bit, you know. But yeah, it turns out the relationship wasn't so good. So the mother actually decided to push her daughter in a different direction than her father.
Okay, so that's the background, and that's what makes her envisioning so particularly different from the engineering peers at the
right.
time. And where did that? Now, it's a little bit out from right field, but the word compute. I mean, is that the word they were using in the 19th century?
I believe the term was poetical analytics or something of the
okay.
sort.
Okay, all right. So go ahead back to the story of her background in how she was seeing what she could see that her counterparts in the 19th century weren't seeing.
Right. So since she came from a pretty different background than her mathematical counterparts, her father was a poet, she was a countess, she was very highborn in society. She had all
right.
of these different aspects to sort of help her look at the world through a different lens. And that really did help her with sort of, you know, finding out ways to use mathematics in different ways. That can also be shown, once again, through... She's credited with making the first algorithm, which is
right.
Computer instructions. So basically, one of the ways she was able to do that, one of the reasons why she was so good at that, is quite probably because of her diverse background.
And for anybody who's knows our map in the city, perhaps, and I don't know if you knew this, Stephanie, but we do have a street named after her.
Do we?
Yes, on the way to the Irvine Transportation Center, south of the Spectrum. It's you turn left on Ada, and you can get on a train.
Oh,
so that's the first time I had become familiar with her because somebody explaining what's the basis for the street. So back to what she was doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of her biggest contributions to the mathematical and computing world. We're creating the first algorithm.
Yes.
And it also sort of just in general creating that different perspective of looking at mathematics and computing and reallocating their purpose.
What was Grace, Stephanie, what was Ada trying to, what were they solving? What were they seeing their application going to?
Originally it was meant for solving sort of like typical math problems. I don't have any off the top of my head
right now. But it was a theoretical thing. There wasn't some kind of like with Turing, his work was about a deeply applied problem and that kind of a thing. But with this pioneer in computing, I'm just wondering if there was something some development historically speaking that it needed a solution that she contributed. She was dealing in a theoretic world. There wasn't some puzzle that she had to solve for a practical industrial social need.
There wasn't a specific puzzle that she worked on, but she did work on a lot of theoretical things as well. And
okay.
she also did write the instructions for applying these things.
So if you want, I don't know if you want to talk about how she might have fallen out of off of our site. But before we talk about Grace Hopper, do you want to, or shall we talk about how both of them tended to sort of we lose sight of their contributions? Shall we talk first about Grace Hopper?
Let's talk a little bit about Grace Hopper.
Okay.
First.
Okay. Grace Hopper was born in 1906. Died in 1992. She was a rear admiral of the U.S. Navy. They didn't name her Amazing Grace for nothing. Tell us about her contributions, Stephanie.
Well, first of all, one of the greatest inventions that she had was she actually helped create the first compiler. And what a compiler is basically it's something that scans through a program to sort of make sure that everything is in the right place, that there's nothing ridiculously out of place that would make the computer sort of like be unhappy. So that was one of her important contributions. She also popularized the idea of machine-independent programming languages, which led to the development of COBOL, which
yeah.
is, it's a pretty important language. Back then it was used kind of a lot for, especially the things she was working on.
In the military.
Right.
Okay. Right.
She's also credited with popularizing the term debugging, which is a way to say fixing glitches in computers or glitches in a program. And that the funny story about that is
yes.
Debugging, when you say the word debugging, of course it has the word bug in it. And that actually comes from the word there was a bug on...
A moth, I guess.
Yeah. There was a bug on her computer, specifically a moth. And because of that, it's just become popularized into this really, really well-known term all around computer science. So if you ever hear someone say, oh, I had to debug something, it just means, oh, I had to fix something. So...
Wow. So, and she lived until 92. So she continually, did she stay in computer science engineering, or was she more, did she get pulled into large, more sort of administrative work in the Navy, or was she able to continue to work at this engineering?
As far as I know, she actually, well, she went to, I forget which college, but at some point she actually was offered a professorship there. She was offered a position to be a professor there, but she turned it down in favor of staying with the Navy and working on the Harvard machine.
Oh, and what was the Harvard machine?
It was just one of the projects that she was working on. It was very important at the time, but...
Before or after World War II?
After.
After, okay.
After. As far as I know, it actually, again, computing. Specifically what it computed, I'm not sure, but it might just be because it's a military thing.
Oh, right. That's the big black hole then. For those of you who've just joined Ask a Leader, my guest is Stephanie Ang, one of the leaders of the Women in Information and Computer Sciences Club on campus. She is with the UCI's Information and Computing Sciences School talking about and giving women in computing science their due. We're talking about Ada Lovelace, Grace Hopper. Are there any other women that you want to mention? Well, we're talking about that. Well, these are the focus. So why is it now, Walter Isaacson, who wrote the definitive biography about Stephen Jobs, and I think he probably along the way of developing that book, he realized, oh, there's some women here in the background. And that's probably in that research he realized it was the impetus for him writing his book that was just released in October of this year, The Innovators, Poetry and Programming Coming Together. The Innovators, let me just leave it at that. So that's I think where people are now having a heightened sense of Ada Lovelace's and Grace Hopper's presence. So what, I don't know if whether you know from general your own training in computer science or from what Walter Isaacson is talking about, what happened? How did Ada just drop off our radar, so to speak?
Well, as far as I know, one of the reasons why she dropped off our radar was because in some cases she seemed to be overshadowed by, like, the triumphant man doing some sort of accomplishment later on, and that just sort of overshadowed her. But then
maybe the
also...
win in World War II, that maybe that kind of tremendous feat, sort of, that might have had a part of it.
Right, definitely. Oh. You know, different social events at the time sort of pushed her into the background. Another thing is there's actually some dispute over whether or not she should be credited with creating the first algorithm. Some people think that she very strongly did, and then some people believe that it was the credit goes to somebody else. I'm not entirely sure.
Another woman?
No, to a man.
A colleague of hers,
mm-hmm,
in England. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's very important. I'm certainly recommending the Innovators. I've heard the interviews. I haven't read Walter Isaacson's book yet, but it looks very interesting. And actually, the biography for Mr. Turing there's lots of really good reads in computer science. So there's lots to do, folks. When you're done with your finals and you've got those lulls in the holiday celebration, there's tons of things to read that we're bringing up here today. So. Another reason for your being here, Stephanie Ang, is to talk about the Girls in Coding Workshop coming up on Saturday. So tell us all about what we need to know, and we'll be sure to include more contact information in the summary for the podcast that we post.
Okay. So the Hour of Code Workshop, that's what's happening this Saturday, again, December 13th. It will be happening from 1 to 3 p.m., and it'll be happening at the ICS third floor laboratory.
And that is building, we'll put up what building number that is, but ICS is there, right there on on Peltison Drive, you can see it, the ICS.
I don't really know the road so well, but I do know that if you see a building, It's sort of shaped like a square with a hole in the center. That's
right.
The right building.
Okay. On the plaza, it's sort of hemmed in with some of the engineering buildings. It's hemmed
right.
in between the engineering building and Peltson Drive. That's where you can see it. Stash your car somewhere on that, the Mesa Court housing, the parking area there. So,
right.
So at, from 1 to 3, what kinds of details, who's eligible, what do they need to bring in registration fees and that kind of thing? Where do they RSVP?
Well, this is definitely a free workshop, so
okay.
we definitely invite anyone who is in the mood to come, anyone who is willing to learn. We do especially encourage girls to come to this workshop, and you can RSVP at tinyurl.com/WICS Hour of Code 14.
Tiny. Okay. I'll get that all down again, and we'll post that as well. And so which you said, now I'm not sure who's your target, what sort of age range for these girls?
The age range
women.
For these women should be around middle school age.
Middle school. Oh, these girls. Okay. Well, and I'm sure posting it, but that's what's lovely to have you on here for all six of you that are listening to the show, folks, and all the 800 that are listening to the podcast later, you know that this opportunity. And so you're hoping to catch people from all over Orange County? I mean, that's the idea.
Right. We're looking to catch people from all over Orange County, okay. Especially people with any kind of interest in computing. You don't need any prior experience. This is just sort of a way to dip your feet into the water and experiment,
get,
right.
feel the accessibility and the aesthetic and the curiosity, the fascination. That well, I thank you, Stephanie Ng, on short notice, was kind enough to bring this commemoration of Women in Computing Science and the announcement for an opportunity for girls to start their coding engines on Saturday, if they haven't already.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for being on the show. Stephanie Ng, one of the leaders of the Women in Information Computing Sciences, about the upcoming workshop, as I said. Well, this brings Ask a Leader to a close. I want to thank everybody for listening today. Next week, we're going to have on the good dean of UCI's Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky. He's got a new book out about the U.S. Supreme Court. That is, unless he has to serve on jury duty. We'll not know until probably the night before or the morning of. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everybody, for listening.